Ladies and gentlemen, the George Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived. This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right, welcome back. All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. And this is the night that President Barack Obama will be giving his final speech. He's going to be giving his final speech in the city where it all started, which is right here in Chicago, Illinois. That speech is about to get underway in 10 or 20 minutes from now. I will still be on the air. I may cover some of it. I'm not sure. But if I don't have some of it tonight, I'll have some tomorrow, some parts of the speech tomorrow. And that's one of the things that's going on that's exciting around here in Chicago instead of always hearing about some shooting somewhere. All right. So that's the news tonight, and that's big news because he's doing it in Chicago. He's doing it where it all started. He is he wishes he had another 4 years. Some of his supporters wishes he had another 4 years. He's going to talk about his accomplishments. He's going to talk about the things he wished he could have done. A lot of people, I'm hearing that his approval ratings are very high, a seven-year high. And he's going to be thanking everybody who voted for him. I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. I voted for him twice, somewhat disappointed, but he did the best he could with a Republican Congress. And the Republicans continue to hold power in Congress. And that's Jeff Sessions, the senator, he's one of Trump's picks for a cabinet, and he's being grilled on Capitol Hill right now as I speak. He's swearing up and down that he's not a racist. So, you know, we're going to see where that goes. You may have heard about both of those topics, those things that they're talking about now. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. Trump is not liked. I don't know how some of you guys feel about him out there. But from my perspective and from everybody that I've talked to and every poll that I've seen on Trump's likability, it's way, way, way down. Even Trump knows it. And I don't know. I don't know what to expect with the Trump presidency. We're just going to have to see what happens. All right. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me right here on Blog Talk Radio. It's going to be interesting. And once again, I want to say my guest today, if I can read this on the marquee here, it's author Elliot R. Cass. He's going to be talking about women problems. That's all I see for now. All right, and commentary on the George Wilder Jr. Show. As always, I have hoped everyone had a super Christmas and an awesome new year. I know I did. I really did. I enjoyed it. I was with, you know, my family, at least part of it. All right. And it was great. It was beautiful. It was great. It was wonderful. And can't wait till next year, the holidays. It's always fun for me, and I always enjoy it. I'm doing a Christmas book for next year, a Christmas story, actually, and a second one, and that's interesting. I'm also going to have more stuff to write and publish this year. That's great. I mean, I'm just cranking it out, folks. What can I say? All right, visit my author page on Amazon. Just put George Wilder Jr. up in there, and that should do it. And it is very, very windy outside. I mean, it is totally windy. I mean, you go outside, you step outside of my studio here and you'll get blown away. You might get blown into Lake Michigan. It is just that high. I mean, the wind is so high in Chicago that it's uprooting trees. Yeah, onto some homes. And it's really high. It's not that cold, but the wind makes it feel colder than it is. It's windy. It's raining. It's been gray all day. You know, it's been miserable out here, out here in Chicago. And I hope, folks, that wherever you are in the world, I hope that you're having some great weather and everything is fine and dandy and all of that kind of good stuff. I want to say one more time that be kind to one another. Be nice to one another. If you see someone in need, help someone out. I mean, you know, especially if the person is legitimately in need. We got a lot of scammers out there. But be kind to one another. Stop arguing, yelling, and screaming, and bitching at each other. Love each other. Shake each other's hand. Hug each other. Kiss each other. Do something. Be nice to one another. Stop all the shooting and the killings and all of this stuff. Because you know what? When you're yelling and screaming at people, at other folks, no matter what reason, you're depleting yourself of all that energy that could go to somewhere positive. And that's the truth. Be kind to one another. Be nice to one another. Help one another out. You know, don't try to scam or con or, you know, do anything like that. Be yourself. All right. You've been listening to George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. I say this so much, I should have it down pat, right? All righty. Be kind to one another once again. Let there be more people helping other people. And that's the greatest thing. I talked about this yesterday. That's the greatest thing about Americans. Americans help Americans. We don't need all the political BS. We go out there and we help people who are in need of help. And one of the things about helping people who are in need is that they appreciate that you've helped them. I mean, they appreciate it like I don't know what. It really is appreciated. And that's enough payback for me. When someone appreciates something that I've done for them, helped them to prolong their life or prolong their career, that's enough payment for me. I don't need their money. I mean, I just need someone to say, thank you, Mr. Wilder. And that's it. That's it. You know what? Because that's what this show is all about. making the world a better place one show at a time. And that's what my books are and stories are about, making the world a better place one story at a time. Even though some of that stuff is fiction and ridiculous, but the underlining message or premises and or premise in everything that I write is all about making you, myself, and others better people. And the only way we can make the world a better place is we have to, each one of us have to look in the mirror and look at ourselves. If we are not right inside, then we have to change it. And like Michael Jackson said, the late Michael Jackson said in one of his hit songs, Man in the Mirror, if you want to make a change, look at yourself and make that change. If you think the problem is you, if the problem is you, you got to make a change. That's the only way the world is going to be, you know, made a better place. Under Donald Trump, I don't know what's going to happen, but still in all, we are the people. Donald Trump gets too out of hand. We can always throw his ass out. We don't need an impeachment. We can just, you know, protest and, you know, whatever. We can get him out of there if he does a bad job. I'm hoping Donald Trump is a successful president. I'm not hoping for the worst from this guy. I'm hoping he is a good president, a thoughtful president, a rational president. Right now, I don't see it. Okay, I don't see it right now, but you know, he's still at this moment, at this juncture, doing this broadcast, he is still president-elect. So, you know, I am rooting for the guy. I didn't vote for him. I'm totally against him on some things, maybe a lot of things. But anyway, he's the president, so we got to, you know, deal with him until he screws up. And some people say he will screw up. But I'm not wishing that he is a failed president. I want Donald Trump to be a successful president. I want every president who is president of the United States to be successful. I wish no one ill will. You know, so there you go. 347-857-1762. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. And it looks like we're going to have some fun. Like I said before, my guest is author Elliot R. Cast. We're going to have commentary. We're going to have some fun, folks. Just keep it right here on the George Wilder Jr. Show. I'm your radio host, Internet Radio, and it is fun. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
Yeah, they are really revving it up for Obama's last speech in as president of the United States, his last speech. And there's been some wrangling about Donald Trump's inauguration. They're wondering how many people are going to show up, if anybody's going to show up. You know, even Donald wonders if anybody's going to show up at his inauguration. I mean, we got, I think it for this presidential last speech of Obama, I mean, there's 20,000 people that's going to be at McCormick Place right now. They're getting in right now. I'm pretty sure they're being seated as I speak. And like I said before, folks, I'm going to have a clip of that speech on the show tomorrow. I don't know if we can get it tonight because it actually hasn't started yet, but we're going to try and get a clip of it, of that speech. If not in its entirety, then at least some portions of it, maybe the most, you know, the most important things we're going to try and pick and clip out of that speech and air it tomorrow on the air. So stay tuned for that. If you can't listen tonight, you know, we're going to have part of it, partials of it, if not the entire speech tomorrow. Okay, so that's what's going on in Chicago, folks. President Obama has come back to his hometown to give his farewell speech to the nation. And 20,000 people, I'm thinking more than that, because these people are really, really in Obama's corner. They really love him. They really like him. Even though Obama himself said that he wished he could have done better. But anyway, some of these reporters, some of these news outlets are going back in time and touting Obama's accomplishments, you know, and even they are even broadcasting his failures, if you want to call them failures. A lot of people are blaming that on the obstructive Republicans. And that's something, folks. The Republicans damn near control the entire Congress during Obama's term. I remember in 2010, 2009 and 10, when Democrats controlled Congress, they were bickering and bitching. They couldn't get along with each other. They were competing for FaceTime with the TV cameras. You know, they just could not get along. I remember this vividly, because I was in the corner and they were just bitching on, they couldn't get along. They, you know, and suddenly the Republicans stormed into office and just about all of them were out of a job because they couldn't get along. They couldn't get anything passed because they, you know, didn't like each other. And these politicians were progressive. And since then, the Republicans have been in control of both houses of Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives. They have been in control. They're in control now. They're in control of the White House. A lot of people who voted for Obama twice decided that they were going to vote for Donald Trump. Some of them feel that they were disappointed. And Obama knows this. He knows it. They did not want, including myself, did not want an Obama third term Hillary Clinton. Okay? That's the main reason, one of the main reasons to why Obama lost. And the other reason is that people did not vote. And that's one of the biggest reasons to why Congress is still in the Republicans' hands. People did not get out there and vote for their senator or their representative. They stayed their asses home. And when you stay home, that's a vote for a Republican. And that's all that is. That's how the Democrats lost. They didn't want another Obama term because they felt disappointed by Obama. I mean, in some of these black communities around the country, blacks still, some of them feel that Obama has done nothing for them. He hasn't visited their community. He hasn't said anything. Same thing with Hillary. Hillary lost a lot of these states and cities because she did not visit a lot of these states and cities. Trump did. So they felt that she was not with them, that she was not, didn't care about their vote because she didn't visit them. And Trump did go to some of these cities, inner cities, and talk. And he talked basically what he was saying. Some of the things he was saying was that Obama hasn't done a damn thing for you. I'm going to do everything I can to make your life better. This is what people wanted to hear from Obama and Hillary, and they didn't hear it because they did not go to some of these specific areas of the country to espouse that. And a lot of people in those cities felt, you know, slighted. And they voted for Trump. A lot of African Americans, I've said this several times on the show before the before he became president-elect, that a lot of people were pissed off and upset and angry at Obama because they figured that he didn't do anything for them. A lot of people who voted for Obama back in 2008, they are in a lot worse, they're a lot worse off than ever. Unemployment in the Black community is higher than it was when Obama ran for office. You know, I mean, I voted for Obama twice. I voted for him in 2008 and I voted for him in 2012. I didn't really want to vote for Obama in 2012, but I did not want to see Mitt Romney take office. You know, so we're having the Obama last speech of his presidency in Chicago tonight. And it is riveting. I mean, people are just enthusiastic about hearing his last speech, even though some people are saying that he didn't do a lot of things he could have done. Some people are blaming that on the Republican obstruction in Congress. And some people are just blaming it on Obama. I mean, Obama, this guy is one of the greatest speech givers I've ever known since Martin Luther King. I mean, he can give a speech. I mean, it makes you, I mean, he talked about hope and change, and we all believed it because his speeches were just so riveting. But after that speech is over, we found out that it was just talk, just talk. Okay. A lot of people are going to disagree with me. That's fine. This is a democracy. You're allowed to disagree, you know, but we are having Obama in Chicago. And he calls Chicago his hometown, and I agree. It is Obama's hometown, and I just did not understand, and a lot of Black leaders did not understand why Obama started his presidential career, his political career from Chicago, but yet he never actually really addressed the mounting violence in this city, the shootings, the killings. He never really addressed it, you know, to its fullest. And what we did not need from Obama was talk. We needed action. We did not need for him to throw more money at the Chicago Police Department to fight crime. We needed Obama to come to the city of Chicago, the city he calls his home, and talk to some of these gangbangers, these thugs, these criminals over here in on the north, not on the north, but on the south and west sides of the city. He would never do that. And we all were pleading with him to come, but he never would do that. And throwing more money at the problem is not going to solve it if you do not have a plan and solutions in place. That is paramount. And no matter how much the federal government throw money at Chicago and hiring police officers who are totally inexperienced in handling sophisticated criminals, it's not going to work without a plan. And they have to have a plan. How do they get a plan? Look at New York. Look at Los Angeles. Two cities that are larger than Chicago. And they have lower crime than Chicago combined. Look at what they're doing. Look at other cities and states that are doing to lower crime, who have lower crime, and adopt some of the procedures and policies that they have. Do not keep saying that the gun laws are not that effective. Keep saying that. You know, you have a job. You're a police officer. You got to go out there and fight crime. I mean, if you got officers who are afraid to go fight crime, then you should not be on the force. Because Chicago is, for as long as I can remember, Chicago has been a hotbed of crime. You know, especially the west and south sides of the city. You know, and I've said this many times on the show. I think that a lot of the politicians, the superintendent of police, the commissioner, all of these people should drop everything that they're doing and make lowering Chicago crime their top priority. You have to, because if you don't stop this murder and carnage every night, every weekend, what else? Nothing else matters. Nothing else matters if you can't walk down the street without getting robbed or shot. Nothing else matters. If you can't sit in your apartment or sit in your home without a bullet coming through the door or the window. Nothing else matters in the city of Chicago except for lowering the crime statistic that happens. And God almighty, it is terrible. 762 murders, killings last year, 2016, 4,331 shootings total. You have to do something about this. Chicago is now America's number one city for killings and murders. And the police admit that they are laxed on crime. So this is awful, folks, for the city of Chicago. It is awful. And I think a lot of the politicians should drop everything that they're doing and concentrate on eliminating, if not lowering, the crime statistics in the city of Chicago dramatically. Dramatically. But is that going to happen? No. No. That's not Rahm Emanuel's mantra. He tries to look away from the crime or pretend that is not happening or throw it all on his police superintendent. However, we need him to focus on lowering the crime statistics in the city of Chicago. This city, it's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful town. It's a great place to live. We should not be the murder capital of the world. It's a great town. It's a good city, beautiful city. We just don't have the right people in place who care enough about lowering crime in the city of Chicago. And I'm talking about the mayor, I'm talking about the governor, and I'm talking about the superintendent of police. We don't have the right people in place. New York and Los Angeles, they have the right people in place. Those people know how to bring down crime. Chicago and the officials in this city, they don't know how to bring down crime, or they just don't give a damn and just don't care. This is why I say we have to vote these people out. We have to get their asses out because they're not doing anything. Our kids, our children are dying. Our kids with so much potential are dying too soon. And all we get from these people are excuses or pointing the blame somewhere else, as if the police department doesn't have a stake in this. I'm pretty sure everything I'm saying they're denying, but that's fine. That's fine. Because that tells me that they're going to start trying to do something to lower the crime statistics in this beautiful, wonderful, great city. As I've said before, they should make lowering crime in the city of Chicago dramatic. I mean, they should make it their first and only priority, because what is else is there? You know, lowering crime should be top priority, and everything else should be, you know, come after that. Because we've got people leaving this city in droves. We got people leaving this state in droves. But the politicians, they're not going to tell you that. But we know. We know. And a lot of the people who are still here, especially on the west and south sides of the city, they are still there because they can't afford to leave. Anybody and everybody who can afford to leave Chicago, they're going to leave. They are going to leave unless they are dedicated. And I would probably say to most people, stay in Chicago. If you love Chicago, stay in Chicago. Fight for your community. Fight for your community. Get in these politicians' asses about the crime that's in your community. Because these people were elected to office to serve, protect the people of their state, the people of their city. If they're not doing that, they're not doing their job. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. All righty, we are going to, let's see what we can, what we got. Okay, be a great parent, be a great person, and enjoy the gift of giving back.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends, and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs, or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school, and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day. His dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me. Because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe? He bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the 3rd one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question, why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask, because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser, because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying, as if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence. Like me. Because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out.
Jesus.
Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. The top news of today is Obama is in Chicago and he's getting ready to give his last speech of his presidency. Okay. And we're waiting for that. It may start as soon as my show is over. But we will have that speech, I'm told, we will have it in its entirety. So if you should miss it or anything like that, I mean, we will have it tomorrow on the George Wilder Jr. Show because it has not started yet, you know. So it will be all over the place. So if you don't have cable television, if you don't have pay-per-view television, you can find somewhere to hear the speech. Go online. Pretty sure somewhere online they're gonna have it live. It's his last speech, so obviously the media wants the world to hear it. So you know, it's gonna be available. So I would advise anybody. I was advising and tell anyone to tune into the speech. But however, if you should miss it, you can tune into my show tomorrow, and we will have the entire speech, if not bits and pieces of it. The most important elements of the speech, we will have it tomorrow right here on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And like I said before, you know, I'm wondering how will Donald Trump's inauguration go in terms of people coming by to celebrate it, because I'm being told that it's going to be a washout. Nobody's going to show up, not the number of people who are showing up for Barack Obama's speech tonight, that Trump's inauguration will not be nowhere near that. Because a lot of people are just, let's face it, America does not like Donald Trump. But I'm going to tell America, give this man a chance. Look, I didn't vote for him now. Give him a chance. Do not wish him bad luck, because we don't want no president to be wished bad luck. We don't want no president to fail, because if a president of the United States fail, it just simply means America fails. Okay, so I want Donald Trump to be successful. Will he be? I don't know. Following him and knowing him, I don't have any confidence in him at all. But this could change. This could change. I mean, he jumped on Meryl Streep, a great actress. I talked about this yesterday. She criticized him of being a bully towards a disabled person who he mocked and said he did not mock. I mean, it's all over the place that he mocked this disabled player, actually, he was a news reporter. It's all over the place. It's on video and on television. So he lying. He did mock this person, and he's saying vividly, emphatically, that he did not. And it's there. Just like he said he didn't say that he grabbed women's pussy, and is right there on tape using the word pussy. You know, so I honestly think he's not fit. You know, I honestly think that he done really blew it with Hollywood, because he picked on Meryl Streep, calling her an overrated actress. If there's anybody that's overrated, it's Trump. His supporters overrated him, because he's going to come back and probably screw all of them. You know, Meryl Streep is not an overrated actress. She's won 3 Oscars, and she has all kinds of awards and accolades probably sitting in her home on her mantle. What has Trump got? What does he have? Well, you can say, well, he's the president of the United States. Maybe by default. By default, a lot of people are going to say. A lot of people are going to say he's president of the United States because he asked Russia to hack Hillary's emails, and they did. That's why he's president. It's four agencies within the United States that are saying that Russia had some sort of influence on the American election. Donald Trump is saying, no, that didn't happen. And you tell yourself, who in the hell is Donald Trump to say that the CIA, the FBI, Homeland Security, and another are wrong? Who is Donald Trump to say this? He probably don't even know what a computer is. I'm pretty sure he probably don't even know how to click on a computer. You know, who is Donald Trump to say that all of these agencies, 3 or 4 agencies, are wrong, saying that the Russians played a part in his election? Nobody. Donald Trump is talking about being president for 8 years. A lot of us don't think he's gonna make 4 years, maybe not even 2 years. But still in all, I do not want this guy to fail. I want him to be successful, because if he's a successful president, America is successful. Because right now, we are the laughingstock of the world with Donald Trump. We are in the sewer with Donald Trump. We have lost a lot of prestige around the world with Donald Trump. And that is no doubt about that, folks. Of course, the people in Donald Trump's camp, they're going to deny all of this. This Kellyanne Conway, she's just pathetic. She kisses so much of Trump's ass. It's just phenomenal. But there is no doubt about it. America has gone down a few notches under this guy. And he's talking about making America great again. America always have been great. The only thing Trump is going to make America, and I hope that he doesn't, is less great than what it already is. But I don't want to wish failure on him. I don't want to wish that on any president or anyone in general. I want people to be successful. I want Trump to be successful. Will he be? That remains to be seen. Will he get all of us killed? That's that remains to be seen. You know, is he in bed with Russia? I think he is because, you know, I mean, he's got to be. I mean, we never saw his taxes. We don't know his investments or any of that. I think Trump is emphatically in bed with Russia. Vladimir Putin. I think Putin, that's a hell of a name. I think he's in bed. I think he has some dealings with Russia because he seemed to be on the Russian side more than he is on the American side of this thing. But I do not want him to be a failure. But he's got some work to do if he's going to bring Americans together. There is no doubt about it. He has some work to do, folks. Trump does. Because right now, I think 3/4 of Americans in the United States, they don't like him, period. I mean, you go to social media, you go to some of these other sites, you go to some of these liberal sites, even some of these Republican sites, a lot of people are skeptical of Donald Trump. But I'm saying for everybody to just take it easy. Let's see what this guy is about. Obviously, he's going to undo Obama's legacy. The Republicans are going to undo everything, especially ACA, American Affordable Care Act, which is some people call Obamacare. Okay, they're going to do a lot of things. Anything that Obama done with his executive power, Trump can go in there, go into the White House as president of the United States, as the next president of the United States, and just erase all of that off the books. Bing, it's gone. Everything that Obama has done with his executive powers, Trump can erase it because none of it was legislatively passed. He just kind of just used his power to do that. And it's power that another president can come in and just, you know, get rid of. So, and that's what Trump supporters expect him to do. But if you get rid of Obamacare, a lot of people are going to be sick. A lot of people are going to be without health care. And that's a shame. And the Republicans say that they're going to replace it with something. They don't even know what, but they're going to replace it with something. And one of the things I do know, you don't replace something without having. You don't replace Obamacare without having a replacement on hand. That's what they do not have. They keep saying they're going to replace Obamacare, but they have nothing to replace it with. And if they do wipe it off the books, and they come up with something, they're saying that it will be fully acted within 5 years. That's going to be a lot of people dead within 5 years. So I don't know if Trump is going to back off eliminating Obamacare. I don't think he's going to do that. I actually think he's going to gut and repeal Obamacare. I think this is a misnomer. I think that he's going to do that. I say I think because I don't know, but all signs point towards Obamacare being repealed and a lot of other things that Obama has done. The Dreamers, they're going to take away protections for Dreamers, for Hispanics, for illegals. That's going away because some of the people that he's appointing to his cabinet, he's going to make sure that they do that. But I'm pretty sure a lot of these people, before they do anything or decide anything, they're going to have to deal with Trump. Trump is going to be one of those micromanagers. He's going to be looking over everybody's shoulders, seeing what they're doing. And they're going to have to, before they actually put anything in play, he's going to say, hey, wow, talk to me about it first. He's got to give them the go ahead to do something like that. He's going to be one of those micromanagers. Okay, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Obama is speaking tonight in the city of Chicago, the city that launched his political career. He's going to be speaking at McCormick Place right there on the lake, on Lake Michigan. A lot of people are expected, 20,000 plus, and it should be exciting. We are going to have his speech in its entirety tomorrow, because it has not started yet, maybe sometime after the show is over. So we're going to do that. And I will listen to it, folks. I will be a part of it. And I'm going to say, I think everybody out there should probably listen to the speech, and, you know, because it's his last speech. It's his last hurrah. So he's going to do this speech. He's going to make this speech. It has to be the best speech of his life, because he's going to want this speech to be remembered by all of his supporters, even those who do not support him. You know, like I've just got through saying, Obama is a great orator. He gives a great speech. There is no doubt about it. I mean, in 2008 and 2012, I mean, he revved up his voter base. He just couldn't do it in 2016 with Hillary Clinton for other reasons. But he is one of the greatest speech givers in history, right next to Martin Luther King, I believe. And I'm kind of excited about it. I'm kind of excited because I know he's going to do a good job on the speech. He always does. He may not, you know, have done a lot of the things that we wanted him to do, that he could have done. You know, a lot of people are pissed off about that. That's one of the reasons why Trump is in office. And another reason could be because the Russians manipulated the American election at the behest of Donald Trump. And we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
I'm Keith Olbermann, and this is The Resistance. He said, quote, you'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday. He said he knows a lot about hacking. He said he knows about the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and other computer systems, quote, things that other people don't know. What do you know, he was asked Saturday night, that other people don't know? You'll find out, he said confidently, on Tuesday or Wednesday. But Tuesday night, he tweeted that the intelligence briefing on Russian hacking, he put insult quotes around intelligence and Russian hacking, had been delayed until Friday, positing perhaps more time needed to build a case. Very strange. Later Tuesday night, CNN reported there had been no hacking review scheduled that day for Trump by the CIA director nor the director of national intelligence. NBC reported there was one, but it had always been scheduled for Friday. Independent reporter Mark Ambinder reported there was a scheduled briefing that was delayed from last week because of the family emergency of one of the intelligence officials, that the White House would get that briefing Wednesday, congressional leaders Thursday, and Trump Friday, and it was identical to what Trump would have heard last week. Trump has said nothing except to again attack other Americans and to again pretend he knows everything, and Wednesday morning to, incredibly, to take sides with Julian Assange, who is an enemy to this country and an enemy to democracy everywhere, and at best a de facto Russian agent. Julian Assange said a 14-year-old could have hacked Podesta. Why was DNC so careless? Also said Russians did not give him the info. And quoting Fox News, Julian Assange on U.S. media coverage, it's very dishonest, more dishonest than anyone knows. The dishonesty here is all Donald Trump's, with Assange, for whom Trump wanted the death penalty in 2010 and the cretin Hannity as his fellow travelers. We, the American people, the victims of Trump's disloyalty and his deranged attempt to position himself as the only person who knows the truth, have found out nothing in the 4 days since Trump began to play this ridiculous, dangerous, un-American game. We still have no idea what those things are that he supposedly knows that other people don't, nor who told them to him, and we are waiting. This was not just his usual boast, not just his usual dismissal of this country's intelligence services, not just his usual lie about the intelligence community and the Iraq weapons of mass destruction, which was not failed intelligence, but rather intelligence manipulated and altered and falsified and turned on its head by the Bush administration. This was a man not 3 weeks before taking power, insisting this country should not investigate what the Russian dictator did to our election. A man demanding that the rest of us, from John McCain to me, need to get on with our lives. A man suggesting, again, he also said this in July, that the best response to computer hacking that might have altered the course of history was to stop using computers and to go back to using messengers. This is a man on the eve of ultimate power in our country still insisting Russia is right and America is wrong, and he knows, quote, a lot about hacking, and he knows things that other people don't know, and you'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday. Trump's silence through Tuesday and now Wednesday and now based on this tweet, presumably through Friday, leaves him very few ways out of this ludicrous boasting, unless by Friday you have forgotten about all this. His incoming press secretary, Sean Spicer, already so far in over his head he needs a scuba suit, flailed around the other day trying to walk back Trump's boast and to suggest the tin pot tyrant elect was really talking about conclusions he had reached from classified briefings. This excuse might have worked if Trump had not spent so much time explaining he does not attend, need, nor worry about classified briefings. You'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday. Well, we have not. And of course, even if we had found out, even if we yet do find out, Trump will still have painted himself into an impossible corner, just a different impossible corner. About the hacking, quote, I know things that other people don't know. Who told them to you, Trump? If it's from American intelligence briefers, you said you don't believe them. If it's from American intelligence briefers, why are you revealing or merely referencing secret classified information weeks before you're legally permitted to do so? If it's not from American intelligence briefers, who was it from? Was it Vladimir Putin? Did he tell you Russia didn't hack the DNC and try to swing the election so it would have you in office? How long did Putin know? How long has it been since he told you? Did he tell you this before the election, Trump? Why have you not told America? Why did you not tell America even just last Saturday night or Tuesday instead of another tweet worthy of a snot-nosed teenage boy? Did Putin tell you not to tell us? Why did you agree to conspire with Putin to conceal this information, even if it has only been concealed since last Saturday? Did you inform American intelligence of what Putin told you? And if so, how quickly did you do that, Trump? What are the things you know that other people don't, Trump, were not told to you by American intelligence nor by Putin? Who then? How do they know? Who told them? Why have you not told America what they knew? Is your hacking source General Michael Flynn, who reads and believes and disseminates conspiracy theories, bluntly, insane conspiracy theories about pedophilia and Sharia law and Democrats ritually drinking body fluids? Is your hacking source Julian Assange, who for Speaker of the House Ryan steals and is a, quote, sycophant for Russia and has long since lost any credibility among conservatives or liberals? Is your hacking source Trump Alex Jones, the radio nut, who believes Sandy Hook never happened and the dead bodies there were child actors? Is your hacking source the National Enquirer, who you parroted when it claimed Ted Cruz's father was involved in the Kennedy assassination? Is your hacking source the individual you have repeatedly cited as a computer expert, your 10-year-old son? Or your hacking source and the things you know that other people don't know, and the part about Tuesday or Wednesday, and the part of a delayed briefing that was reportedly never scheduled in the first place, did you just make them up because you thought we were all too stupid to expect you to deliver? In the summer, Trump insisted the election was rigged. In the autumn, the intelligence community revealed conclusions that maybe he was right. In the winter, Trump suggests we should not hold hearings to see if the Russians subverted our freedoms by remote control. In a tux on New Year's Eve, Trump insists about the hacking that I know things that other people don't know and you'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday. In a peevish tweet on Tuesday night, he throws up another accusatory smokescreen by writing, perhaps more time needed to build a case, very strange. And in his most disturbing tweet yet on Wednesday morning, he defended a man facing a sexual assault charge in Sweden and probable espionage charges here. And he attacked the men and women who defend us. So now we need to have not just hearings about the hacking. We need hearings about what Trump meant last Saturday night, what he knew, why he promised to reveal it, and why he is concealing it now. In short, to revise a great question from history, what did Donald Trump know, and when did he stop knowing it? Resist. Peace.
All right. Thanks, Keith. As always, he's always interesting. Okay. Fox News secretly settled Bill O'Reilly's sexual harassment case. I mean, the Republicans think harassing women is nothing. They don't hold anybody accountable for harassing women. And they have all the proof in the world. Okay, it says here that when she rebutted his advances, he tried to derail her career. That's typical of a Republican. Bill O'Reilly, this guy is one of the commentators reporters. I don't think he's a reporter. I don't think he's a journalist. He's just one of the, I'm gonna say this. He's one of those mouthpieces from Fox News. He's been he's been on Fox News for years. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Once again, I want to say Obama is giving the speech of his life in the city of Chicago. We are all proud of that. Has he gotten everything he wanted? No. Are we all proud of him? Well, no, in a way, but his approval ratings are very, very high. And I'm going to have that speech in its entirety tomorrow, because I don't believe it's gotten started yet. So we're going to have it tomorrow. All right, let's go to the phones. All right, you're on the George Wilder Hello? Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
George, it's Elliot Katz calling. I'm really sorry. I'm calling in a snowstorm here in Toronto, and I just got home right now.
You're a little late in calling, right?
Yeah, I'm much late. I apologize. But takes me 10 minutes to get home, and it took me over an hour. You want to do
we're having
an hour?
Okay, I was going to say we have some bad weather in the city of Chicago too. The wind is blowing, high rains. The winds were so high that it toppled a tree. A tree fell over onto our house. Yeah, so that's and it's been gray and horrible and everything. And I just wanted to say that I know what you're saying. We're having some terrible weather here too. All right, so everybody out there, we finally got hold of Elliot R. Katz, and you're going to be talking about women problems, something to that effect.
Right.
Okay, right. Go right ahead. Give us a little bit of your bio, and then get right into the book.
Okay, so I was married for 10 years, then I got divorced, and like a lot of people, I blamed the other person, and then I came to the point of asking myself, you know, what do I have to learn from this? And so I went off on a journey to learn what does it mean to be a man in a relationship. And the first thing I learned just by listening to other men is that we're all confused. We're all trying our best and it's not working. We can't understand why we think we're being such great guys. And women, they don't like us. They hate us. They divorce us. Like we're being such nice guys. So I went on then I started reading books about relationships. They said nothing to me. And then I turned to the timeless wisdom that, you know, in past generations that fathers used to teach younger men about being a man, and I was blown away because it coincided with what I heard women say is lacking in men today. They don't show leadership, they don't make decisions, they don't take responsibility. There's this giant disconnect. You know, men today, we've been told, like, don't be controlling. We don't want to be controlling. That means, well, just let her make all the decisions. Women hate that. So the bottom line is women want men who are leaders. Women want men who can take charge and deal with situations. They don't want men who they have to tell what to do. They don't want men who say, oh, you decide whatever you want. They hate it. They want a real man. They want a man who takes charge. They want a man who wears the pants. What do you think, George?
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I think, and you forgot to mention one thing, a woman wants a man who is good in bed, too.
Okay. Well, yes.
No
yes,
doubt
about
that.
That's part of being a man. You know what?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but
I'm
but
just being a little bit more
showing leadership. Does she want a man who, like, says whatever, you take the lead in bed? No. Right? She wants a man to take, who takes her to bed, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, that's just part of being a man. That's just one element of being a man. So,
absolutely.
You know, I can go back to my own relationship. I mean, I was married for the first time and I got divorced. And, you know, I think it might have been a little bit of that, because I don't look at myself as being controlling. I don't look at myself as being abusive or anything like that. And I think that's one of the reasons it ended, because I wasn't as tough as she wanted me to be. And I
right.
didn't want to be tough. I just wanted to be, the nice
guy.
And you're right. Just want to be a nice guy. And sometimes women don't want that. They want the guy. They want a bad guy, because a lot of women find the bad guy to be a little bit more interesting than a good guy.
Right. But they want a strong guy. They don't want a guy who says
yeah.
whatever you want. When, you know, there's a decision that has to be made. Oh, whatever you want. And the guy thinks, I'm being so good. Well, just do whatever she wants. I'm being so good to her.
Yeah.
No, she wants a man who takes charge,
yeah.
who makes a decision. She wants a man she can look up to. She wants a man who's a rock that she could lean on and takes charge. Not a controlling tyrant, but someone who's like, there's a problem. He steps forward and deals with it. He doesn't wait for her to tell him what to do. You know, a lot of men, they think, I come home, she tells me to do all these things, I do them. I'm a great husband. No, she doesn't want to have to tell you what to do. She wants you to know what's going on in the home and the family, see what situations need to be dealt with, and take charge and deal with them. And you know what? This book is striking a chord around the world. It's been translated to 24 languages and by publishers in Europe, Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And I get emails from people, and you can look on the Amazon reviews as well. People say, men say, this book has saved our marriage. Women say, if my husband had known these crucial truths, our marriage would not have disintegrated. There's a lot of comments like that.
Yeah.
Men say the same thing. If I had learned this a year ago, I wouldn't be divorced today. It's really, it's like so much of the messaging we hear is like, oh, don't, mm-hmm. you know, being a man is toxic. Being a man is aggressive and violent. No, being a man is being a leader. You know, when I tell women, they say, what does the book say? I said, it tells a man when a man should be a leader. They smile. That's what they want. Yeah, I want a man who's a leader. I don't want to make all the decisions. I don't want to wear the pants. I want a controlling tyrant, but I don't want a man who's waiting for me to tell him what to do and thinks he's being such a nice guy.
And it doesn't
want leadership.
And it doesn't matter their income.
You know what? What does a woman want? She doesn't want a guy who's like doesn't work, just sits all day watching television. But you know what? As long as you're earning a living,
I understand that. I guess what I'm saying is a woman don't want a certain kind of a man just to shower her with gifts and presents all the time. You know, she wants, like you said, that leadership, that love, that someone to take charge. If someone is not, if a man is in her life and he's not taking charge in a certain kind of a way, then she's going to rebuff all those gifts, all that money, all those presents, and go with the guy who is the leader.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, you see a lot of couples, they're so mm-hmm. wealthy. You think, what kind of problems could they have? They have so much money, they don't know what to do with
yeah.
it all. You see them getting
yeah.
divorced, and you see it's like the man wasn't being the man. He was working hard, bringing in all the money, you know, had a great lifestyle, but he wasn't a man to her. He wasn't, you know, showing leadership at home. He was just like giving her the money and letting her say, here, you do whatever you want. No, no, she wants a leader. It's like dancing, you know? When couples
yeah, yeah.
dance, yeah, they want the woman wants the man to take the lead. Could you imagine when a man says, oh, you take the lead to the woman? She feels she's not dancing with a man, you know? It's the same thing.
You know, I would love to read this book. I mean, you've hit it straight up on the nail. I would love to read this book. I would love to have a copy
well,
of it in my
it
own
you.
Library. I would love to have a copy in my own library, because even I can learn something. I mean, you never stop learning. You learn things every day. And I think you hit on something here, because you just said you got a lot of reviews for it. People are emailing you and talking to you about it. You're saving marriages with it. So it's got to be a phenomenal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's really my goal. You know, you see so many children from broken homes. They're not necessary. Like, really, the husbands, you know, you could blame them to say, oh, my wife has to change. Well, you know what? You can't change your wife. You can only change yourself. And the men start changing themselves and start being leaders, and the women start respecting them and loving them, you won't see so many children from broken homes. It's a tragedy. So,
Elliot,
that's my goal.
Elliot, you've written this book. Have you put any of your experience into this book? Have you gone through something like that to write this?
Well, obviously, you know, that's what the book is. It's my own, like a lot of books of these types, it's my own journey of learning. You know, some of the problems, you know, a lot of men, because men don't often talk about relationships, but really once I was divorced, I would talk about other men. Here, I thought my situation was so unique. Nobody in the world is in this situation. Mm-hmm. I talked to other men. We're all in identical situations, you know. We're being so good. We're trying to please our wives. We're working so hard to bring in all the money to pay for the big house and everything. And it just all collapses. And you think, well, what did I do wrong? And, you know, these are the situations. Like, you have to realize, you know, you get financial stress. People think, well, if I could just earn enough money. But you know what? Financial stress brings up problems that wouldn't have otherwise have arisen. You know, all these things. What does a man really want? You know, the book quotes a lot of ancient sayings. So there's a saying that was like 2,000 years old. Mm-hmm. It says, when is a man's life not a life? And what's number one? When he is ruled by his wife. His life is not a life. It's as if he is not alive. I read that. I said, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Like I have no life.
It sounds like a great book. And tell us all where we can go and find it.
Okay, it's called Being the Strong Man a Woman Wants, Timeless Wisdom on Being a Man. And it's available on Amazon as a paperback and as an ebook, and it's also an ebook on Kobo and iBooks. And you can get it in bookstores, and if they're sold out, just ask them and they'll get it for you pretty quickly. The title again is Being the Strong Man a Woman Wants, Timeless Wisdom on Being a Man. And it's Elliot Katz. And George, I will send it to you if you send me your address.
Okay, I'm going to do once this show is over? I'm going to send you a link to the show. So, but when you get the link, you'll get my email and you can send it back. I'm going to send you a link to the show. The show is, the show has already progressed for about an hour. So, you know, you can always cut it to your interview if you want to do that. I'm going to send you a link to the show in about a couple or maybe 2 or 3 hours once the show is processed. And I'm going to send you a link to the show. All right, one more thing. Can you give us your website?
Okay, it's www.awardpress, AWARD, press, PRESS.com.
Okay, all right.
And
thanks for being on the
email
show.
You can email me through the website and any comments, thoughts. You know, happy to be part of the discussion.
All right, thanks for being on the show, Elliot.
Okay, thanks, George. Apologies
no problem.
For being
bye
late
bye.
Again. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, that was Elliot K. Katz on the George Wilder Jr. Show. He was a little late, and we are a bit late. And I want to say, I believe Obama is speaking right now. Like I said before, folks, we're going to have his speech in its entirety tomorrow. And I hope you join me tomorrow. Okay, here we go.
Bombs begin to fall. Anyone I never saw. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a claw.
Heaven help us, oh, heaven
now lay me down before I go to sleep. In a troubled world, I pray the Lord to keep. Keep hatred from the mighty and the mighty from the small.
All right, this is George Wilder Jr. You're listening to the Talk of Our Times. Obama is about to give his last and final speech and in the city of Chicago. That's what makes it so exciting. I'm broadcasting this show from the city of Chicago, and it's going to be something, you know, and they're already talking about Trump undoing everything that Obama has done, you know, and that's a possibility. As a matter of fact, it's a reality. So he's going to give his last speech and hoping that it resonates down through the years. Obama giving his last speech from the date of this show. He has about a week in office and then Donald Trump takes over. And a lot of people aren't too happy about that. But you know what? I mean, give the man a chance. I've said this. I said, give him a chance and see what he can do. We know that he can be a bully. We know all the other things that involves and explodes around Donald Trump, but let's just see what's going to happen and go from there. And like I said before, I will be back on the show tomorrow, folks, to give you a recap of the Obama's last speech in its. Okay, I was just told I have 90 seconds in my ear. I will be back to give you the speech. We're gonna be as soon as it's over, we're gonna try and get a clip of it, and we will have it on the show tomorrow. So I hope you guys out there join me tomorrow on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thanks for everything. Bye bye.